Hot Type with Evan Solomon.
Nobody that we've ever spoken to on Hot Type provokes as much as a reaction as Noam Chomsky, both lavish praise for having him on the show and harsh criticism. Since the Vietnam War, the controversial MIT professor of linguistics, the public activist, the intellectual, has been really at the center of the discussion about the use and abuse of American power. Well, with the violence continuing to go on in Iraq, Noam Chomsky has a new book out. It's called Hegemony or Survival, America's Quest for Global Dominance. And I thought this is a good time to sit down once again with Noam Chomsky. So we came here to Boston to this nondescript building where the man that the New York Times calls arguably the most important intellectual alive works. And we spoke about everything from his treatment in the American media to the word terrorism to what may happen in the future. Let's take a listen. You argue in the book that the fundamental principle that this administration and really past administrations have functioned under is that hegemony is more important than survival. Can these two things function together?
Those who sought domination, hegemony, often did so at their own severe risk. You look at the history of warfare, you'll find that those who started the wars often were defeated. And sometimes devastatingly defeated. The differences now are scale. Survival of the species was not an issue before. It is now. It has been ever since nuclear weapons were around, and it's getting worse. The Bush administration has been criticized for refusing to sign the Kyoto Protocols or to take any steps towards reducing, significant steps towards reducing what could be environmental catastrophe. I mean, what we're taught, what we have drilled into our heads, your driving force in life is to maximize your own wealth. Therefore, it's perfectly rational to maximize your own wealth and destroy a world in which your grandchildren can live. Of course, it's also pathological. And the same is true of a lot of other things. I mean, say, take, militarization of space. Right after the National Security Strategy was announced in September 2002, the Space Command, which is in control of futuristic military programs, say we have to move from control of space, which we now have, to ownership of space. Ownership of space means no challenge will be tolerated. It's ours. You get out. Others are going to react to this. In fact, they already are. And they're all moving to automated response systems, launch on warning type systems. This is a recipe for disaster. One of the things I discuss in the book is what was just discovered last October a year ago, at the Havana retrospective on the Cuban Missile Crisis. Turns out that we were literally one word away from a nuclear war. If one Russian submarine captain had not canceled an order.
He was actually ordered to fire nuclear weapons.
It was his decision whether to fire nuclear weapons. The others said yeah, he said no. They needed agreement in order to do them. These were torpedoes, nuclear-tipped torpedoes. It's almost certain there would have been a nuclear response. And then you're off and running.
President Bush said that democracy is the only path to national success and dignity in the Middle East.
If we were reasonable, our reaction to this would be to completely discount it. Because any leader you pick, anyone you like, is going to produce this rhetoric. That comes with a job. What you do is look at the practices that lie behind it.
You cite the case of Turkey, for example, and Turkey's reaction to the war against Iraq. And you explain how this war illustrated what the Bush administration means when it says democracy.
Yeah, and Turkey's a striking case. But what went on with regard to democracy this year? That's pretty interesting. In the case of Turkey, to everyone's surprise, including mine, the government took the position of 95% of the population. And they were bitterly attacked by the Bush administration.
95% of the population said you should not allow Turkey to be used as a staging ground for U.S. troops to go into northern Iraq.
To everyone's surprise, Paul Wolfowitz, he went so far as to condemn the Turkish military bitterly for failing to prevent the government from carrying out this terrible act of accepting the position of 95% of the population. In fact, he called on them, he basically ordered them, to apologize to the United States for their bad behavior and to recognize that they must help the United States. That's democracy.
So when Bush says that democracy is the only path to national success and dignity, he means democracy if it follows the American version.
Democracy if you follow our orders. If some miraculous conversion took place and the people around Bush decided, okay, we really are interested in democracy and human rights, there are actions they can take instantly. I mean, why support the murderous, brutal dictators like Islam Karimov in Uzbekistan, sort of comparable to Saddam Hussein? And this is not just the United States. I mean, Britain just withdrew its ambassador from Uzbekistan because he had the honesty to point out that the dictator who Britain is supporting is a murderous, brutal tyrant who, in fact, I think it was his example, boils his opponents to death in boiling water. Yeah, that's our conception of democracy and human rights.
I sat down about a year ago with Henry Kissinger, and he said to me, we've moved to a new era post 9/11. The old world where you could not preemptively strike is over because the security threats now are totally new to national sovereignty. And therefore, we're in the age of the preventative or preemptive war, and it's rational. Now, you talk about it in here saying this is what you call the grand imperial strategy. Is Kissinger right to say that this is a post-9/11 development?
He knows perfectly well that that's nonsense. The U.S. has always had that strategy. Go back to the early stages of World War II, before the U.S. entered the war. We always have what we'll call preventive war, meaning aggression, in our pocket, and we'll use anytime we feel like. Henry Kissinger knows this perfectly well. He knows he's not a fool. He knows the United States carries out attacks against other countries all the time. It's just you attack people who are in your way. Well, there was something different about the national security strategy announced in September 2002, kind of a crucial event. The national security strategy, it is a declaration saying that the U.S. Will retain, must dominate the world by force if necessary, the dimension in which the U.S. reigns supreme. It will do it permanently, and it reserves the right to prevent any potential challenge to its domination by the use of military force if necessary. That's the essential content. That's what the next issue of Foreign Affairs called the new imperial grand strategy. And this did cause enormous reaction around the world, including the foreign policy elite right here. And not that it was a new doctrine, but that it was extremely brazen.
It was
declared. It was in your face. You know, you're telling the world, this is what we're going to do. We're going to attack anyone we want without any pretext, without any international authority, and we're going to do it because we're stronger than you. So that's stupid. You don't make a speech about it. You don't put up a flag in front of everybody saying, here I am, I'm coming to attack you. In fact, Arthur Schlesinger, no big radical, pointed out right away.
Who worked in the Kennedy government and the great historian.
Major historian. He said, quoted Roosevelt, you know, Pearl Harbor is a date that will live in infamy. And he said he was right. And today it's Americans who live in infamy. Because as soon as the U.S. bombed Iraq, he said, look, we're following the policy of Imperial Japan. And they also talked about anticipatory self-defense. So we've adopted the policy of Imperial Japan and other aggressors. I mean, if you announce to people, I'm going to come and attack you whenever I feel like it, they don't say, gee, thank you, here I am, please bomb me. So they turn to the weapons that are available to the weak. Weapons of mass destruction, which you can probably make in a high school chemistry lab or biology lab somewhere, and terror. Those are the weapons of the weak. And apparently that's exactly what happened. It led to a sharp spike in recruitment for al-Qaeda-style organizations. Experts on North Korea and Iran pointed out right away it's probably a factor in stimulating their search for weapons of mass destruction.
So this idea, the manifest destiny, America as the vanguard of history, this means that no matter what it does as the imperial force in the world,
its
actions are benign and justifiable, yeah, or defensive or preventive or preemptive, and everyone else you're suggesting
is a terror. I'm suggesting that's the way the terms are used.
So when we read today in the paper that the terrorists seek to kill coalition forces, in your book you say, wait a second, let's re-understand the term, and you say it's fair to call the United States a terrorist state.
See, that's actually interesting. What the Iraqi forces are doing, shooting down a helicopter, is not terrorism, not under the official U.S. definition. However, what the U.S. does is terrorism under the official definition.
Yeah. Is that right?
Yeah.
So is every country
terrorist? Yeah. I wouldn't say every country. Maybe Luxembourg isn't, or Andorra. But countries that act further weight around in the international scene very commonly are involved in terror. I mean, in the case of, say, Nicaragua, the U.S.-run terrorist war virtually destroyed the country. The number of casualties, it's higher than the total number of U.S. casualties in all U.S. wars in U.S. history, including the Civil War. That's fairly serious. If you go south of the U.S. border, there's something called the other 9/11, not in the United States, but south of the border. The other 9/11 is September 11th, 1973, when operations supported and backed by Henry Kissinger, among others, led to the bombing of the presidential palace in Chile, the overthrow of the parliamentary government, and the killing, by conservative estimates, of about 3,000 people. It's probably maybe twice that. 3,000 people in Chile is the equivalent of a counterpart of 60,000 in the United States. If 60,000 people were killed on September 11th, our September 11th, do you think that people would notice that? Yeah, they would. But when we do it to them, it's like a mistake. Or
would you say that the mission in Iraq is an act of terror?
The mission, I agree with Arthur Schlesinger. It's just outright aggression. It's like Pearl Harbor. He's correct. They announced very clearly, we're going to invade Iraq, and we're going to do it without any pretext and without international authorization. I mean, various pretexts were given, but pretty hard to take seriously.
So this weapons of mass destruction and the rebuilding...
Maybe they believe...
Is there just pretext you're saying for...
And there's no question about it. You can see the way they follow one another. I go through some of this in the book.
So this idea that it's going to be a domino effect of democracy, he's going to bring democracy...
Notice that this is after the fact. Since all the other pretexts have collapsed, and you still need a pretext, you fall back on what's the universal declaration of every leader, whether it's Hitler, Stalin, Tony Blair, or anyone else. We're going to bring them democracy and freedom. I mean, you really have to admire the discipline of educated people who are able to watch all of this and not burst out in laughter, pretend to take it seriously.
All right, when we come back, we'll hear more from Noam Chomsky about his new book, Hegemony or Survival, America's Quest for Global Dominance. Stick around. People sometimes read your stuff, and we've talked over the years, and they say Chomsky's an anti-American.
That's an interesting concept. Now, suppose somebody in Italy criticizes Berlusconi's policies. Would anybody call him anti-Italian? I mean, try that on the streets of Milan. People collapse in laughter.
A year today, there's another presidential election. And again, I quote the New York Times, the political challenge posed to President Bush after the deadly helicopter in Iraq, more losses of the losses. How to keep public opinion from swinging against him over Iraq while not abandoning his quest to bring a stable democracy to that country.
You know, they ought to be writhing in embarrassment for saying that. On what grounds do they believe that George Bush is trying to bring a stable democracy to Iraq? The only grounds are, our leaders told us that, and we are so subordinate to power that we worship them and revere them. And if they say something, we repeat it.
You don't think
not asking whether it's true. Like, is it true that he's trying to bring a stable democracy to Iraq? You're not allowed to ask that, as in the quote you mentioned. That wouldn't appear in a self-respecting newspaper.
How do you keep public opinion from swinging against him? How does he? How will he?
Karl Rove, the campaign manager, has already pointed out that the two party activists are going to have to do the same thing they did in 2002, and that is push the panic button. Their policies, domestic policies, are quite unpopular. They're very harmful to the general population. They're devastating to future generations who are going to have to pay the costs of this reactionary statism where you have a huge state and you cut taxes for the wealthy. There's cost to that. And the population doesn't like it, so you got to get their minds off it. You have to frighten them. You have to make them think that some demon's coming after them, so you have to huddle beneath the powerful leader who'll protect you. And if they have to manufacture a crisis, they'll do that. Just as they did in September 2002, a massive propaganda campaign within weeks had driven U.S. opinion completely off the spectrum of world opinion. Over half the population by the end of September thought that Iraq's an imminent threat to the United States. The misperceptions are extraordinary. They've been well studied. And they're the result of a very effective government media propaganda campaign, which frightens people. I mean, take, say, what happened on May 1st of this year. It was very interesting. May 1st is the date when George Bush landed in combat
gear. Abraham Lincoln.
Carefully placed so you get the right television images. Again, any self-respecting newspaper would have collapsed in ridicule. The front page of the New York Times reported that he gave a victory speech with a powerful Reagan-esque finale to the war. What were they referring to? They're referring to Reagan's speech explaining proudly how the U.S. is again standing tall after what? After having conquered the nutmeg capital of the world, Grenada, where 6,000 U.S. special forces succeeded in overcoming the resistance of a couple of dozen middle-aged construction workers, won 8,000 medals, and we were standing tall. And that was a powerful Reagan-esque finale. The United States was saved from destruction because an airport they were building might have been used by the Russians. And what's more, the more astute press on May 1st was quite aware of it. The Wall Street Journal report didn't talk of a splendid Reagan-esque finale. It said, this doesn't have anything to do with the war in Iraq. It's the opening of the presidential campaign.
So it's a democracy of futility, then?
That's the point. Bush succeeded in getting a majority of the working class vote, even though he's harming them. And the two issues on which people voted, the main issues, were religiosity and gun control. I mean, are they the top issues of concern
not
to working
people? Not even electoral issues, really.
They're not issues to working people. They care about their jobs, their pensions, their health care, and things like that. But those things are not on the agenda, for good reason. Because on those things, public opinion and elite opinion differ sharply. So they are not on the political agenda. They're barely discussed in the media. And people are left with voting for whether the guy is religious or not. The point is to create top-down forms of democracy in which the public is marginalized, elites remain in control, and they support power. Democracy, real democracy, means the public can participate, can do something. And that's dangerous to power, so you got to prevent that. And when George, he may not be smart enough to understand what he's saying, but when the people around him praise their love of democracy and the New York Times collapses in applause, that's the kind of democracy they're talking about.
Can nation states act decently?
Yeah, no law against them. Sometimes they do under citizens' pressure. Under pressure from their own citizens, power systems sometimes do decent things.
All right, when we come back, we'll hear more from Noam Chomsky, especially his views on the American media and how it treats him, especially the New York Times. So stick around.
Since September 11th, the media have opened up somewhat. I mean, I was on MSNBC for a long discussion program in November for the first time ever. It's a reflection of public concerns that are forcing the media to open up a little.
Are you surprised you're becoming a bestseller again? You want, in this kind of thing?
I'm talking to you. I'm not talking to CBS. Oh, yeah, outside the United States.
New York Times Magazine this past weekend.
That was interesting. Did you look at it?
Yeah.
That's an interview which could not appear in any country in the world outside the United States. These ridiculous questions came along. I mean, nobody would ask me, what do you think about words for genitals? This is the kind of thing which appears in, if you go to a supermarket, you know, and you look at the stuff on the counter.
So you think they tried to make you look like a clown in that?
I don't think they tried. I think it just comes naturally to them. They cannot comprehend that there could be something that's a millimeter away from approved doctrine. You can't imagine that appearing anywhere. It's even true of the photograph. They sent a photographer down, and he did an elaborate photography session, took, you know, hundreds of pictures. Perfectly nice guy, you know, got along fine. At the end of the session, he said, would you mind taking your glasses off? I said, it's ridiculous. You know, it's not me. You know, I take a picture of Robert Redford or somebody. I never take my glasses off unless I'm going to sleep. You know? She said, well, just for fun. What pictures did they use? The ones without the glasses. And it's trivial, but symbolic. The point is, truth is insignificant. It's not even a value. So, yes, they ran an interview, but of a kind that says a lot about the New York Times.
It's good to see you always, as usual. Thanks a lot. No, it is. That was interesting. These guys probably just want a two-shot. No, I know you're...
Okay. Do you want me to take my glasses?
Yeah, as I say, you want to take your glasses off? You know, over the years, I've spoken with Noam Chomsky many times. I've read many of his books, and, well, I've disagreed with a lot of things he's written. But when I read his new book, Hegemony or Survival, America's Quest for Global Dominance, I have to say that I found it overwhelmingly convincing. Synthesizing an array of often overlooked public documents, Chomsky builds a very credible argument that America is embarking on a reckless and dangerous imperial mission. You know, the best books provoke you. They make you challenge your own assumptions, even when you disagree with the points he's making, and this book does just that. Hegemony or Survival, America's Quest for Global Dominance, is published by Metropolitan Books. I would highly recommend it. Tune in this Friday night, 8 p.m. Eastern, for the famed Crack Panel. That's right, they're back with the best book list of the year to fulfill all your holiday shopping needs. Consult our website, cbc.ca/hottype, for all the times that show will air on the weekend. All right, that's it from Boston for this week. I'm Evan Solomon. I'll see you again in 7 from America. Take care.